And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn. It is another absolutely gorgeous day out there. In fact, it's warmer than yesterday. The weather folks told us it would be. And it's just very pleasant. There's a bit of a breeze. But other than that, it's just terrific. We're already up to 73, 74 degrees. Looking at upper 70s today, nice. We had a stretch of nice weather for the better part of a month, starting in late August and through almost all of September. I mean, we've had a couple of rainy days, but not very many. We've had a lot of sun. I'm getting spoiled, aren't we? I think, yeah. Getting spoiled a little bit. And from what I see in the long-range forecast, we may be back up into the 80s by the weekend. So we're not done with the summer-like temperatures yet. Yesterday, it was okay. It was a little cool if you were outside because we ended up with some cloud cover here and there yesterday. The sun would pop out a little bit in the afternoon, but then the clouds would come in and it was kind of breezy. It wasn't bad. It felt like fall. And it's starting to look like fall, isn't it? Yeah, most of the trees are still green, but they're a dull green now. You know, they're not growing anymore. And you're seeing more and more of the trees with a little touch of color on the outer branches. Yeah, you know what's coming. There's a lot of news out of Washington, of course, with the impeachment inquiry starting. Or will it really happen? I don't know. We're going to reserve some time tomorrow to talk about it. We'll get a little bit more information. It's still a work in progress in terms of the release of the transcript of the phone call that President Trump made with the leader of Ukraine and so on and so forth. They're still going back and forth. So maybe we have a little bit more information about it. We'll talk about it tomorrow, see what you think. I don't know whether they're ever going to go ahead and go through with that or not. We'll see. Certainly a flurry of news, though. We're going to talk. It's kind of a medical show that we have lined up for you today. We're going to be talking, first of all, about fibromyalgia. You know what that is? No? You've probably heard the term. Maybe seen a drug ad on TV or something for fibromyalgia. Our first guest, and we'll be talking with her in just a couple of minutes. She's a doctor with the Mayo Clinic. And the Mayo Clinic, pretty much the number one hospital in the country. So we'll be talking about information on fibromyalgia from the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Barbara Bruce will be our guest. And then we're going to be talking about obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD for short. Actually, and I didn't realize this, OCD goes a lot further than just straightening rugs and, double-checking to see if your door's locked and that sort of thing. The thing you saw on TV with the Adrian Monk, remember that show? It hasn't been on for a few years now, but it goes a lot further than that, and it's often tied in with addiction, addictive behaviors, and addictive substances. So we'll talk with Maggie Simone about that. OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. Do you know somebody that battles OCD? Do you? Yeah, I do too. It's actually rather common. And then on the final segment of the program today, we're going to be talking about mystical energy healing. I don't know whether I can buy this or not, but a lot of folks do these days. And we'll be talking with Andrew Himmel about that. So it's kind of a show dealing with conditions and medicine here on the program today. So without any further ado, let's take a break for a minute or so, and then we'll come back to chat with our first guest, Dr. Barbara Bruce from the Mayo Clinic. here on the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn on WISR. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Preparation for fall has already started, and Osterling's Lawn and Garden has all the tools and items you'll need to keep checking the boxes off your to-do lists. They have pruning tools, rakes, bulb planters, and fall planting onions. Even fall flower bulbs will be arriving this month. They'll have tulips, irises, crocus, and more. Make sure to grab heavy trash bags for all your leaves and yard waste. It's also canning time at Osterling's Lawn and Garden. There are plenty of cabbage cutters, apple pickers, and canning salt. Get prepared for fall with Osterling's Lawn and Garden.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening, every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
Listeners, coming up on the It's Your Turn program, my name is Dave Mulwarky. We're going to be talking about fibromyalgia. I'm sure that most of you have at least heard that term, but what is it? We're going to be talking with Dr. Barbara Bruce, who is affiliated with the Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Bruce, nice to have you with us here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So let's start with that question straight away. What is fibromyalgia?
Actually, fibromyalgia is a chronic disorder. It affects upwards to 10 million Americans, primarily women. It's a disorder that has been described to me many times as, imagine that you woke up every morning and felt like you had the flu. My patients feel achy, they hurt, they're tired, they feel exhausted, and have trouble getting on with their lives and their day.
Is there any particular part of the body that seems to get these aches and pains?
Widespread, all over. But there are also lots of other symptoms that come along with the pain and fatigue, such as trouble with tummies and trouble with bladder and trouble with headaches and jaw pain and many other pain disorders that can also go along with fibromyalgia.
The Mayo Clinic has published a guide to fibromyalgia, strategies to take back your life. Is this available in many places, or do you get it online, Dr. Bruce? Where, how do you get it?
Should be in your local bookstore, library, and certainly on the Internet.
A lot of myths about fibromyalgia, right? A lot of people think they might understand it, but they don't. Even some physicians, I guess, huh?
You know, it turns out that this constellation of symptoms that we call fibromyalgia have been around for decades under different names. There have been a lot of misunderstandings about fibromyalgia, with patients being told that it's not real, that it's just all in their head, that there's no such thing, that patients are attention-seeking or drug-seeking. And research is telling us that this is inaccurate, and we're starting to understand what is causing fibromyalgia. And it seems to be a central nervous system problem that affects the sensory system.
Is it difficult to diagnose, Dr. Bruce?
Difficult to diagnose. My patients have had symptoms on average 10 years before they get an accurate diagnosis.
Wow.
So yes, there's some healthcare providers who still are not aware of the changes in the information related to fibromyalgia, and there's some healthcare providers who continue to think that they don't believe that it is a real diagnosis. So patients often struggle.
Does the physician, the practicing physician, just examine the symptoms that present in the patient, or is there a blood test or something like that for fibromyalgia?
You know, that's been part of the problem. There is not a blood test for fibromyalgia or an X-ray, and often patients are worked up for other ailments that can have similar symptoms, and certainly lots of things can cause pain and fatigue. So those things are examined, but with a complete examination and with the appropriate testing, physicians are able to make an accurate diagnosis of fibromyalgia.
Should your PCP be able to start you on the road, or do you need to see a specialist about this?
You know, actually the book lays out kind of a nice plan for how patients can approach whether they suspect they have fibromyalgia, whether they've been told they have fibromyalgia, whether they've been diagnosed with fibromyalgia but they don't want to have the diagnosis of fibromyalgia. We lay out a way to educate patients about this disorder, what it is, what it looks like, and then encourage patients to bring that information to their primary care physicians to begin to sort this out. Often patients will end up seeing a rheumatologist. Dr. Andy Abril, who's my co-editor, he's a chair of rheumatology at Mayo, and they will often see a rheumatologist to sort this out because there's a lot of overlap in the symptoms of fibromyalgia with other rheumatologic diseases such as lupus or rheumatoid arthritis. They are not the same thing. Patients can have both, but often that is a place where it gets a bit confusing because of the overlap.
I have a review copy of the book, The Mayo Clinic Guide to Fibromyalgia. I've got it in my hand here. It seems that it's written in a way that the average person will be able to understand it, including with a lot of color photographs and charts and so on.
I have had in my career an opportunity to see thousands of patients with fibromyalgia, as has Dr. Abril and an array of scientists and physicians across Mayo Clinic. So we've been able to draw from that information, draw from the evidence that's being produced around the world as this research has exploded. And what we tried to do is distill it down into a guide that walks people through current evidence, research-based, accurate information, and tools that we know can be helpful in moving patients toward a better quality of life, a way to return to their lives and turn down these symptoms.
So there are treatment options for this condition?
There are. There are some medications that are approved for fibromyalgia, and there are lots of other strategies that we outline in the book that can help people to feel better. Our goal in treatment is to reduce the number of flares, which are the increase in symptoms, and to make them less intense. We unfortunately don't have a cure for fibromyalgia yet, but the research is ongoing.
Do we know anything about the cause? Is it congenital or is it contagious? Do you catch it from somebody?
We don't think that you catch it. We don't think it's contagious. We don't necessarily know what's causing it yet. We know it's a central nervous system problem. Research is looking at things like viruses. They're looking at things like some sort of a physical, like a surgery or an accident or a car crash as a precipitant. We know it runs in families, so the genetics are being examined. Lots of areas of research, but we've not been able to identify a single cause yet. Research is ongoing.
Are there treatment options that won't necessarily cure it, but will help reduce the pain?
Absolutely. And we talk about those in the book and try to lay out kind of a structured strategy, set of strategies, a plan for patients to feel better. And we start with the way that they're thinking about their illness. We want to provide a lot of reassurance and information about what is and is not wrong. Again, partnering with your physician so you've got that support and as you embark on this plan. We talk about ways to communicate with loved ones so that they can, in fact, support patients as they move forward in trying to manage these symptoms. We talk about the way we're thinking about the symptoms. We talk about ways to reduce stress, which we know can trigger flares in fibromyalgia and make symptoms worse. And we talk about improving sleep, which is significantly disrupted in this disorder, and ways to get moving again.
Any idea why it occurs mostly in women?
It's a great question. There's lots of theories. We don't know. Some theorists think that is it a stress factor that women are experiencing or perceiving more stress? Mm-hmm. Is it because men don't go to the doctor? We know they don't tend to doctor as much as women do. Is it possible that more men have it, but we don't know that because they're not being adequately diagnosed? But the number we see, about 85% of our patients at Mayo are women.
Wow. The Mayo Clinic Guide to Fibromyalgia. It's been our pleasure to talk with one of the co-authors of the guide, Dr. Barbara Bruce. Thanks, Doctor. Very informative. Thanks for chatting with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So long now.
Tobacco for Less is Western PA's largest glass emporium, and they now have a store in Butler at Pullman Square Plaza. What makes Tobacco for Less different from other stores? For starters, they have so many glass pipes to choose from. They also feature a walk-in humidor and a vape juice bar. And of course, they carry a variety of standard tobacco products too. The Tobacco for Less Health and Wellness Department stocks a large selection of high-quality CBD products. For all your smoking and vaping needs, check out Tobacco for Less with locations in Butler, Sharon, and Aliquippa.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Welcome, listeners. Great to have you with us on this segment of the It's Your Turn program here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visits with us by telephone today. We're going to be talking about OCD, Obsessive Compulsive Disorders, with Maggie Lamond-Simone. Maggie, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us for a few minutes today.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Maggie has written about this in a book entitled Body Punishment, OCD, Addiction, and Finding the Courage to Heal is the subtitle. The title is Body Punishment. I need to explore this in some detail with you, Maggie, because first of all, before I got the review copy of your book and started perusing it, I thought I knew what OCD was, Obsessive Compulsive Disorder, and I was basing my knowledge, I thought, mostly, I realized on what I'd seen on TV shows and in the movies,
right,
about OCD, and almost always what's focused on there is people who have germophobia or who straighten rugs. And I'm thinking of Adrian Monk and some of the other peoples that we see. I didn't realize that OCD could go so much further.
There's a broad spectrum, excuse me, of compulsions. There's a broad spectrum of fears. I think a lot of people don't realize that OCD can involve fears and obsessive thoughts without corresponding compulsions. it's I guess that's part of the reason for the book, is that people don't realize how deep this can go and how broad the issues are. And I think people can have these fears and these compulsions and these obsessive thoughts and not realize what they have, because they're not what's shown on Monk and As Good as It Gets with the cracks and, you know, having the germaphobe or the need for order, the need for organization. And certainly those are valid obsessive compulsive disorders, but there are many more than that.
Yeah, that's what I didn't realize. So we're not saying that isn't symptomatic of obsessive compulsive disorder. It's just that it's only a small fraction of what are sometimes really paralyzing compulsions, which, by the way, you have experienced yourself, and your book is kind of a recounting of how you've dealt with this throughout your life.
Yes, it's been a challenge. I started with OCD when I was about 4. It was my first earliest memory of, and it was really the simple step on a crack, break your mother's back thought, where I started with the obsessive fear that something was going to happen to my mother if I wasn't there to protect her from her stepping on cracks, ironically enough. And for a child, that's a really, it's paralyzing, and it's a big responsibility to think you are responsible for your mother's safety. After that, I actually started pulling out my eyebrows and eyelashes, and couldn't stop. And that's part of the problem with OCD. One of the debilitating self-esteem factors is that you're doing something that you can't stop doing. And recently, in the last year or two, the psychiatric community has redefined OCD to include other behaviors that used to be called impulse control disorders, like mine, which the hair pulling is called trichotillomania. I also do this skin picking thing, which I thought I used to do to sabotage my chances of ever getting, you know, having a date. But that's also used to be an impulse control disorder, and a lot of these types of disorders are now classified as OCDs, or under that umbrella, because it's something that you can't stop doing, and you want to.
Well, as I said, it was only when I started to read your book that I realized this, and it was only then that I realized where your title came from, because when I saw the title, Body Punishment, it didn't... You know, it didn't quite jive initially until I started reading about, in your particular case, this hair plucking, which you have done since you were a little kid, I guess, huh?
Yeah, excuse me. On the bus in second grade, a little girl that I was sitting with turned to me and said, "You have a clump of eyelashes missing." And I vividly remember the horror I felt at being caught. And I'd been doing it enough to realize that, you know, that wasn't a new thing for me. I wasn't, you know, upset that I was doing it. I was upset that I was caught.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually started this lifetime of secrecy. I have to find a way to hide this. I've tried to stop doing it. I can't stop doing it, so I must find a way to hide it. And I never even thought to research it later in life to see if it was something real. I just assumed all of my life that no one else did this. It was my secret shame. And then when I was 38 years old, I looked down at my baby son lying on the floor, and he was playing with his eyelashes, and I thought, oh my God, whatever this is, I gave it to him. Is it possible that I gave it to him?
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time in my life, and I have a master's degree, I'm a reasonably intelligent individual, for the first time in my life, I Googled plucking out eyebrows and found out that there's a name for it, and chat groups and support groups, and I sat there and wept at the lost years of what would have been different if I had known this as a child, that I'm not a freak. This is a real thing that other people have. It just was, it's changed my life.
Why do you think that there exists such shame about OCD issues? Because people don't understand them, they don't know about them?
Well, I think a lot of it is because they are considered mental disorders. And we as a society are not at a place yet where we can talk about mental disorders without fear of judgment. I think that we have gotten very far in terms of talking about addictions and alcoholism and many other previously secretive issues. I think we're getting better. And I think that talking about mental disorders will someday be that easy also. But I felt like I needed to contribute to that conversation, that people need to start contributing to the conversation to make it easier to talk about.
Listeners, for those of you who have joined us a few minutes late, our guest here on It's Your Turn, this segment here on WISR is Maggie Lamond-Simone. We're talking about her book, Body Punishment. It's about obsessive-compulsive disorders. Is it typical for people to develop this at such a young age? as you did, or does it sometimes not occur in people until they're adults or even older?
I think that it is very common for it to start in childhood. I know many kids now who have it, now that I've been sort of talking about it. My daughter was diagnosed with it several years ago, and she's very confident, I guess, with it. She's very open about it, so kids will come and talk to her. Parents will talk to her, just because once you put that out there that, you know, what she does is something that maybe their child does, it again, it prompts the conversation. So I think there are a lot of kids diagnosed early. I don't know if that means that people who are diagnosed in adulthood start developing symptoms in adulthood, or if they just start recognizing that in adulthood. I'm not sure of the answer to that, to be honest.
Well, there are other issues that are associated with the OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, self-harming, our guest Maggie was talking about, plucking out her eyebrows and eyelashes. Alcoholism, any sort of addiction can also be a problem, and you certainly in your life suffered with that, specifically alcoholism, did you not?
I did. It's a good way to self-medicate, and when you spend the majority of your waking hours really trying to simply survive, it's very comforting to self-medicate. It's very enticing. And alcoholism, I think, is in my family. I have relatives going way back, so I think that was an easy one for me to fall into. There are other addictions out there that I could have fallen victim to. People I hung around with who smoked pot or did drugs, never was into that. So I don't think you choose your addictions, and I find that interesting. I don't think you choose your compulsions when you have OCD. They kind of choose you, and I think that's another thing people don't understand. We don't pick the ones that we want or that are socially acceptable. There are people with obsessive fears about hurting people they love, which can be debilitating. You know, they would never act on it, but the fact that it's in their head all the time can be paralyzing. And we don't choose what our mind does.
One more quick question before we take a break. You'd mentioned when you were looking at your young son, the thought occurred to you, gosh, could I have given this to him? You mentioned your daughter. Has there been any research at all on whether or not there is any sort of a genetic component to OCD?
Yeah, there has been some research, and there has been found to be, I think, what can be described as a pretty strong hereditary component or genetic component. And that's another reason that I wanted to put that out there. I don't talk often about my daughter unless she's with me. I like her to be in charge of that. But I think people need to be aware that if they have those tendencies, especially if they're particularly strong tendencies, that their child may someday struggle with that. And if they can be on top of it and recognize it and catch it right at the start and say, you know what, this is okay. This is manageable. This isn't something you need to be afraid of or ashamed of. Let's go talk to someone. Then you bypass that just nosediving self-esteem that a child would feel when faced with something that he can't stop.
We'll take a quick break, listeners. We have a few more minutes that we're able to chat with our guest, Maggie Lamond-Simone, about her book, Body Punishment and OCD, Obsessive Compulsive Disorders. You're listening to It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll be right back.
Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us. We're going your way. Getting there starts here. Just hop the bus. Easy and economical. Just hop the bus. No car, no problem. The bus will get you there. 'Cause that's what we do. Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us. We're going your way.
Hi, this is Dave Malarkey. I'd like to talk to you for just a moment here about the good folks at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here at Butler. What a great job they do to help those who are less fortunate in many ways. They operate the St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank, of course. They have their St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store in the Greater Butler Mart and their Client Aid Program. And the Client Aid Program helps needy families or individuals, maybe with help on a heating bill or a rent payment at the end of the month. Client Aid. And that's funded through the operation of the thrift store. So you can help by donating items that you no longer need or want to the thrift store. It's very easy to do. Drop-off bins are right inside the door. You can use the container outside. They're located in the Greater Butler Mart. So think about it. Next time you're cleaning the closet or the upstairs, instead of throwing that stuff away, why not donate it to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler? We stand tallest when we stoop to help others.
Do you love home cooking? Me too. And that's what Michael's Restaurant specializes in. From homemade soups to daily lunch and dinner specials and the legendary desserts. Every Friday night, Michael's features prime rib and crab legs for you to enjoy. Hungry for Italian food? Try Michael's Diablo pasta or seafood scampi. Michael's Restaurant, Newcastle Road.
Welcome back, listeners. If you're joining us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visits with us by telephone. She is Maggie Lamond-Simone, author of Body Punishment, subtitle OCD, Addiction, Finding the Courage to Heal. This is a very deeply personal account of Maggie's experiences herself with obsessive-compulsive disorders and addictions. Alcoholism wasn't the only problem that you faced. You also experienced later in your life eating disorders that were related to OCD.
Yeah, I think that's... I was just having this discussion with somebody else whose daughter is suffering from anorexia. I think it's easy when you have an obsessive gene to find different things for an obsession to take hold. And in my particular case, I had this image in my head that if I could get down to skin and bones, I could start over. I could simply start over. And all of my life, I kept trying to find ways to start over and do it right. And that manifested into anorexia. I starved myself. And I think it's easy to fall into an obsessive thought process like that if you've got the obsessive component to begin with. And I'm wondering if someday there will be research done around things like bulimia and anorexia and these body dysmorphic disorders that would help explain why some people feel them and some people don't.
A little bit more about our guest listeners. Maggie Lamond-Simone is an award-winning columnist and author. She has a master's degree from the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. She also has a black belt. And until I knew that, I didn't understand how you had arranged your chapters in Body Punishment, Maggie. I'm assuming that's the connection between yellow belt, red belt, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's actually the name of the book comes from the martial arts. When I first got sober, I had just turned 30 and was passing by a martial arts school on my way to a restaurant for a work function and looked in and watched for a few minutes, and the next morning I just went in and joined, just completely out of the blue. I felt that it was something I needed to do. And when I watched my first black belt exam, I watched the candidates line up and get in this what's called a horse stance, and the upper degree belts had to go down the line of these novices and punch them in the stomach. And just one after the other, they got punched in the stomach repeatedly, and they had to absorb the blow and not show pain. And I remember turning to the friend I was with and saying, you know, this pretty much describes my life right now. And that the title of that activity was Body Punishment. So in my head, all these years, 25 years later, I knew that that would be the title of a book if I ever wrote one about what was going on.
Have they ever done any research as to whether or not stress might be a component in obsessive-compulsive disorders, or perhaps the degree of which OCD is expressed?
I think that there have been studies done around anxiety, and actually one of the ways to manage OCD is with an anti-anxiety drug, because the level of anxiety can actually provoke the compulsions or the fears. And I don't know that they've actually come up with a cure for OCD per se, but at least in my case, in my daughter's case, in many of the children I know have gotten to know over the years who have it, if they can manage the anxiety, if they can somehow control the anxiety, they can control at least the extent of the compulsions and the fears. So I think there's definitely an anxiety component that if that can be managed, the OCD isn't as overwhelming or debilitating.
Do schools and teachers know enough about this? Because, you know, obviously you started exhibiting these tendencies when you were very, very young. It would be crucial, I think, that teachers should be at least able to identify potential cases.
That's a great question. I think that some schools and teachers are probably more more aware than others, or at least have more power than maybe others to be aware, I guess, and to call someone and say, you know, I think your child might have this issue. In my daughter's school, they were very, very good. The school psychologist met with her every week for lunch. Her teacher knew that, you know, she had to be able to reach me if Sophie had an anxiety attack. So whether they were aware beforehand or not, when they were made aware, they were very helpful. I don't know that it's as talked about among teachers or the education profession, and I teach at the college level, as much as, for instance, ADHD and the autism spectrum, which have been much more well-funded and more publicized. So, again, I think that these kinds of other mental disorders will be standard knowledge someday, and if we can just keep contributing to the conversation.
I begin to wonder about some of the TV shows and other places in mass media where we have seen in recent years obsessive compulsive disorder shown. I mean, in some cases, almost in a humorous way. Certainly the case with the Adrian Monk, you know, Tony Shalhoub. I mean, everyone was joking about it. He was always straightening rugs. He was fixing glasses on a shelf. He was doing all this stuff. In a way, that was good because it drew the attention of the public to the fact that, okay, people have this disorder. But on the other hand, it gave no indication whatsoever to the more serious portions of this this disorder. It's not funny at all. It's tragic.
Yeah, it's actually, I think that was a good introduction because it didn't, and I used to watch that with great curiosity to see how it was treated. He never made light of it. Mm-hmm. And he struggled with it. And I appreciated that they allowed that to happen.
That's true.
That Tony's character, yeah, never made light of, you know, he struggled. He was anxious, and he struggled with what his limitations were because of his OCD. And so I thought that was actually a pretty good introduction. I think Lena Dunham has done a great job on Girls, showing how absolutely paralyzing and debilitating it can be. It's frightening, and I think people are someday going to understand the frightening levels that it can get to, but they had to start somewhere. And I thought, you know, I think Monk was probably a decent place to start. Unfortunately, now people have a little misunderstanding, and if I, you know, talk about my daughter, if someone asks about her OCD, and they'll say, well, I'm OCD about my kitchen. I can't leave the house if the kitchen's a mess. And I think part of me feels like they're trying to validate us and make us feel like it's okay, which is really good. And then part of it is really dismissive.
Yeah.
Like you don't understand how bad this is. You know, I'd love for my problem to only be that I need my kitchen straight. You know, I can't leave the house if I think somebody's mad at me. So there's distinctions, and I think people who don't have OCD need to be aware that sometimes, you know, there can be validation, but it can also be dismissive depending on how it's put.
Speaking of validation, our time begins to run short, but does identifying OCD, does putting a name on it, is that a great aid to a person who's suffering?
Oh my God, yes. Oh my God, yes. When I found out what it was that I had, the shame was almost gone. You know, if you know that there's a name for it, it's a real thing. Other people have it. It's, you know, there's research done, there's treatments, there's therapies. It becomes like any other physical or mental, you know, something, a challenge. It becomes another challenge that you can manage. It's when you think that you're the only one that has it, that there is no name, that you just have this thing that you can't control. That's where the debilitating self-esteem creeps in.
Who diagnoses it? What kind of a specialist or physician are we talking about here?
Typically a psychiatrist, psychologist, licensed social workers, almost any level of therapist is well-versed these days in OCD patterns and can diagnose it. Psychiatrists have to, or family physicians have to prescribe medication for it, mm-hmm. typically, but it's any kind of therapist can see the signs and the patterns.
And finally, who's your target audience for this book, Maggie?
My target audience is really adults who either feel like they're struggling with something or have struggled in the past or love someone who struggles with it. But what I'm hoping is that they'll see something, if they see something in a child, their child, a friend's child, a niece or nephew, and say, you know what, I think we need to talk about something. I just read this book about a woman who does that. And just start a conversation with a child and catch them before that shame starts to creep in.
The title of the book is Body Punishment, OCD, Addiction, and Finding the Courage to Heal, by our guest for the past few minutes here on It's Your Turn, Maggie Lamond-Simon. Maggie, nice to meet you. Thanks for talking about this. It's an important thing to discuss.
Thank you so much.
It's football season, and you need to get your game on at Sir Speedy Printing Center. That's right. You'll score big when you brand your business with custom-printed banners for events, direct mail pieces, or travel mugs, pens or capsticks for clients. Need to order forms, envelopes, or brochures? Free quotes available at Sir Speedy. They can also do bulk mailing, so you don't have to. Are you working on the school or church fall fundraiser? Get a quote for raffle tickets at Sir Speedy Printing Center on South Main Street in Butler. And then you'll feel like you scored big time with the quality and service they provide.
Okay, listen up. You have an opportunity at a huge prize pack giveaway. Quality Life Services Sugar Creek invites you to visit and tour the newly renovated skilled nursing facility, including the 10,000 square foot addition in Worthington, PA, to enter and win multiple giveaways like a Seven Springs Mountain Resort getaway with a two-bedroom condo, cash cards, and more. Visit the website qualitylifeservices.com to schedule your tour Mondays through Fridays between now and September 18th or call 724-445-3000 for a chance to win. Quality Life Services at Sugar Creek. Drawing held September 22nd. Tour and win.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Coming up on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR, by the way, I'm Dave Malarkey, and our guest visits with us by telephone today. He is Andrew Himmel, author of a new novel entitled The Reluctant Healer. Andrew Himmel, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today, sir.
Dave, it's great to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about this book, The Reluctant Healer. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of the plot?
Sure. Dave, it's the story of a young attorney in New York City who is he's torn between mounting evidence that he has the mystical or spiritual ability to heal others and his lifelong skepticism of alternative views. So the main character he's a cautious and conventional type, and he meets a woman who is very much involved with spirituality, and specifically of metaphysical healing. And the main character, Will, has nothing but, let's call it disdain or contempt almost for this worldview. And he never really, throughout the novel, entirely sheds his skepticism, but he is confronted with mounting evidence of possibly his own metaphysical abilities, and that forces him to call into question certain aspects of his own life, certain beliefs that he is held to without question. So it is not a book of advocacy. It's not a book that seeks to promote healing as an alternative way of life. Healing is almost a tool of disruption, and his life is disrupted. And so the novel, to a certain degree, tracks my own marriage. It is inspired autobiographically. The facts are very different, but the central dynamic can be captured by what is true in our own marriage. My wife, Michelle, is an energy healer. We've been married for many years. We've been married for coming on to 27 years now. And I'm an attorney. And I have always retained a certain skepticism. But what happens when you're in a relationship, a committed relationship with somebody that you love? It's easy to be disdainful if you're just talking generally and there's nobody in your life that feels this way about things. Mm-hmm. But change just one little fact, and that person is an important person in your life who you love. It doesn't mean that you immediately discard everything that you've ever believed in and then adhere to everything that she believes in, but you do approach the dynamic from a different perspective. You try to be respectful even as you try to grapple with your own skepticism and your significant other's belief. And what I thought would be a whimsical but ultimately revealing technique would be, what if this skeptical attorney actually begins to display certain abilities? That would make his own turmoil, if you will, his own reflection, that much more poignant. Mm-hmm. Because now it's being brought to home, not just by the relationship, but by what's happening in his own life.
Your main character, Will Alexander, is a no-nonsense litigator, attorney, but nonetheless, following this encounter with Erica Wells, who is sort of a new age mystic, he is, as you mentioned, not only frustrated, but he's certainly captivated by this, right? After his first accidental healing.
That's exactly right, and you really sort of zeroed in on an important dynamic in the book, which is, I mean, it raises the question, why? Why would this person, who is kind of a run-of-the-mill, conventional, reasonably intelligent attorney, what would make him attracted to a woman like Erica? Why is there that connection to begin with? And I think to a certain degree, and this may even be a reflection of some things that have happened in my own life going back, 20, 30 years, to a certain degree, he recognizes the limitations of his own life. And these aren't terrible limitations. I don't mean to use a literary cliche to suggest that, he's a lawyer, he works hard, he provides for himself, therefore, he must be empty. He must be hollow. He must be one-dimensional. No, I don't buy into that. I think people can have jobs, an accountant, a lawyer as myself, other kinds of jobs, and there's probably a lot more going on in their lives. But they work hard, and they're serious people, and they're good people. But to a certain degree, they may feel a certain constriction in their lives. And perhaps meeting someone like Erica Wells, he intuited that this would be a way to, perhaps incinerate the boundaries that have kept him trapped. I think I just mangled a few metaphors there, but a way of freeing him from, to a certain degree, the constrictions of his life. Now, what a way to do it. I mean, there are other ways, right? I mean, you could take a yoga class, I suppose, perhaps study some other way of approaching life and analysis and philosophy. What does he do? He becomes involved with a woman who believes deeply in this world. And so, to a certain degree, his involvement can be explained perhaps by a need to free himself. What he sees is a certain degree of constriction.
So what does he do? This character that you've invented, Will Alexander, does he, to heal people, does he touch them? Does he pray for them? What's he do? Or doesn't he do anything?
Well, that is, again, that's a very incisive question, because he doesn't even know what he's doing, and yet he does it anyway. I don't think he is a bad person, but he is not a classically heroic figure. So what does he do? He allows himself to get involved in this world, and he doesn't quite answer the question for himself, do I have these abilities, even though there is some mounting evidence that suggests, doesn't conclusively establish, but suggests that he might have certain capabilities. And so he sets up shop, so to speak. He hangs out a shingle, even as he recognizes that there may be nothing to this. Now, does that make him a great person, a heroic figure? It truly does not. He is a flawed character, and I think that anybody who was deeply troubled by the legitimacy of whether healing and energetic intervention is capable, is possible, and yet sets up a shop, so to speak, where he literally sees people, it creates a dynamic which is both flawed, and I think he tries to justify this to himself by saying, I don't charge. I don't charge for what I do. You come, you see me, I will spend 10 to 15 minutes with you. Do I touch you? No. Do I chant anything? No. What do? We engage in some kind of joint meditation. Is this nonsense? It could be. Will it help you? Possibly, possibly not. What are you getting for your money? You're getting absolutely nothing, possibly, or you might be getting something, and you may not even have to pay me anyway, because I'm not going to insist on payment. So it's a financial model which directly reflects his own ambivalence. He's struggling with the morality of what he's doing, the logic of what he's doing, and to a certain degree, he assuages himself by saying, you know what, as crazy as this is, as skeptical as I am about this entire world, I'm not going to charge. I'll just let them come to me and let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. So without giving too much of a spoiler alert, that's kind of the approach that he takes. And then things go, they take a certain path from there. But the answer to your question is no. He engages in no particular practice or protocol or physical intervention. He just says to himself, maybe I have this ability, maybe I don't, let's see. And I'll leave it to the client, if you will, to decide if there's going to be any payment.
We're talking, if you've joined us a few minutes late here on this segment of It's Your Turn on WISR, we're talking with Andrew Himmel, author of a novel entitled The Reluctant Healer. Now, you yourself are a lawyer, Andrew. Do you believe in mystical healing?
Well, that is a question that I have struggled with, and the reason that I struggle with it is, much like Will, the main character, I also retain a certain degree of skepticism. I was trained in logic. I went to law school. I'm a civil litigator, so you know that means that I build cases from evidence, and if things are not backed by evidence, you discard the argument or you discard the strategy. And yet, there is a part of me that says, you know what, it's not just all that you can see and hear. There are things out there, there are, whatever that expression was from Shakespeare, there are more things than heaven and earth. And I have seen my own life, my wife intervene with people in a way that has caused them tremendous benefit. Now, does that mean it's because of a specific ability? Is it the placebo effect? Is it some degree of intentionality where it could be explained through a simple, you know, biological processes? If you really believe something or want something to happen, maybe there's some chemical in the brain that's released that addresses the ailment that you have. I don't have the answers to these questions, and so this is a typical lawyer's answer, isn't it? to a certain degree evasive and non-committal. But that's the truth. I mean, if I were to give a yes or no answer to your question, I would be blowing over the conflicts and complexities in my own life. And that's, by the way, those complexities, those conflicts, that doubt, that was the fuel that propelled the creation of this book. So I'm going to hold on to my ambivalence, which is frustrating. It's frustrating for a lot of people. But it is the fuel that enabled this book to be created.
Now, you do bring some humor into this book, which some people might say, how the heck do you do that? We're talking about a pretty serious subject here. How do you bring humor into the book, Andrew?
Well, I try to bring humor into it by gently probing some of the more fantastical claims and elements that some healers and mystics proclaim. And this is the trickiest part of the book, because I don't want to just simply, and I didn't set out to just simply make fun of them. That would be easy, and it would also be funny. It can be funny. You can take beliefs that people have. I think a lot of people have done that with, for example, to take somebody in the news lately, Marianne Williamson, who I consider to be a very bright, intelligent, and forceful woman. She does believe in things, not all of which were on display at the debates, that people could easily make fun of. And there's something about making fun of people in that kind of direct way that rubs me the wrong way. So the humor that I try to bring into the book is a sort of a gentle a view, perhaps pushing some of these views to their logical extremities, but without going so far as to fall into ridicule. It is a very tricky balance, and I think I just have to simply leave it to the reader to determine whether I've struck that balance or not. So the humor is taking a look at a lot of what is claimed by some people, pushing it to a certain degree, and also the humor is just the extraordinary notion that this conventional attorney could even think about changing his life in such a way so as to engage in this kind of process. There is something humorous, some people might say pathetic, but it's a mix of things. It's humorous, it's pathos. But here you have this highly conventional attorney, very buttoned down, and here he is toying with the idea that there may be some legitimacy to this world.
Yeah,
there's humor and tension in that.
Yeah, when you're dealing with, you know, any discussion of the occult, it's funny that you should mention, you know, some people make fun of it. It seems to me it's kind of how the way it's phrased, you know? I mean, if you talk to somebody and you say, do you believe in ghosts? They might, you know, say, well, of course not. But if you're talking about, you know, a spirit of someone who has died, I mean, there are a lot of very legitimate reports of people who say, you know, they can still feel a spirit of a loved one who has passed on. And who's to say, you know? I'm certainly not going to judge that.
You're right, and it's so interesting that you've really sort of identified a very intriguing dynamic about how blurred the lines can be between accepted belief in something that is just dismissed as preposterous. You're absolutely right. People do believe in spirits, in ghosts, in visitations, and I'm not here. It's above my pay grade to say you should believe in these things. But as you point out, a lot of people do. A lot of highly intelligent people do. So what does this mean? Does it mean that it's that they're all nonsensical? No, of course not. It means that maybe it means this. Maybe it means that there is an intuitive sense among people if they are not confronted with the prospect of, you know, immediate ridicule and skepticism, if they're just left to their own devices and if they just look at their own lives and try to recount the experiences that they've had, they will tell you. I mean, I think that if you were to ask almost anybody just a very broad question, have you had any mystical experiences in the entirety of your life, just, you know, even if it's just one, I would say that almost, I don't want to make this a scientific survey, but most people would say, yes, I remember one time. And they will tell you a story about some kind of encounter or some kind of a visitation. And they will tell you, and they will not be ridiculing themselves, and they will not be ridiculing the world and the system. Neither will they be telling you that they're converts. But they will tell you that they've had experiences. So I think that, to a certain degree, this book tries to tap into that ambivalence without going so far as to say, yes, healing is a reality. That was never the point for me. For me, healing or mysticism or the whole world of alternative approaches, these were tools that I tried to use to disrupt Will's life, to make him confront certain restrictions in his life. But these aren't random tools. These are tools that come out of not only my wife's world, but more broadly, the world in which we live in. I think you said it just correctly. There are a lot of very intelligent people who have had these experiences. What do we make of that? I think that we intuit that there perhaps is something out there that our normal senses can't interpret easily.
So what do you think, listeners? Interesting, huh? Yeah, interesting food for thought. It's a novel that deals with two different worlds colliding, really. The concrete world and then the world of mysticism and mystical healing. It's dealt with in this novel by Andrew Himmel. The title is The Reluctant Healer. Andrew, an interesting discussion. Thanks for being with us for a few minutes here today.
Thank you so much, Dave, and thank you for having a show that focuses to a large degree on books and reading, more important than you might realize. Oh, it's wonderful.
Thank you for that. Good to talk with you today, sir.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680. WISR 680, your classic hit station in Butler, will now conduct a test of the emergency alert system. This system is designed to provide you necessary information.